for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Last January, activists in Egypt launched an uprising in Tahrir Square. Demands for political reform led to the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak. A newly elected parliament held its inaugural session yesterday. Joining me to examine the transition taking place in Egypt, Robin Wright, joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Wilson International Center, and Samir Shahata. He's assistant professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. You can join us as well. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you both with me. Joining us from Brussels, Ambassador William Taylor. He's special coordinator for Middle East transitions at the U.S. Department of State. Welcome to you, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you, Diane.
Please talk about how much has changed in Egypt since Hosni Mubarak has stepped down.
Sure. Some things have changed and some things haven't. What has clearly changed is the people of Egypt now have a voice, and they have expressed themselves in what is generally agreed to be free and fair elections for the lower house of parliament. That parliament, as you said, met yesterday for the first time. So that's clearly a change. Free and fair elections are a real change. The people's voices, not only in elections but also on the street, are now being heard around the world. Some things, however, haven't changed. The military played a large role under Hosni Mubarak. The military is still playing a large role now that they actually are the executive power, and until yesterday were the executive and the legislative power. So some things have changed and some things haven't, but on net, it's clearly a positive for the people of Egypt.
Now, that newly elected parliament is dominated by Islamist politicians. What challenges does it face?
The parliament faces challenges that all new parliaments do. They, all of a sudden, the parliament now has real power. The party that won the most votes, that is the Freedom and Justice Party, a moderate Islamist party, that is looking to form coalitions with other parties in the new parliament in order to eventually form a government. The parliament will have to set the rules, set the standards, set the procedures, and again organize itself in a way that can that allows them to perform the legislative functions in Egypt.
And what about U.S. relations with Egypt? What are our priorities?
Our priorities are to see and support a transition to a democratic government. We have strong interests in Europe, in Egypt. Egypt is an important country for the United States and the region. It sits in an important part of the world. It has relationships with Israel, has relationships with Europe. Our relations with Egypt benefit us, the United States, and I believe they benefit the Egyptian people as well. These relationships we want to maintain.
And what's going on with Egypt's economy, Mr. Ambassador? How closely is the political transition tied to the economy?
The Egyptian economy is in deep trouble. And exactly as your question points out, the ability of this government, both the military and the new parliament, to steer the course of an Egyptian economy toward a more prosperous future for the people of Egypt is going to be key to the stability and the longevity of the political transitions. Right now, the reserves that the government has are going down rapidly. Tourism is way down. Investors are holding off. The Egyptian government, that is both the civilian government and the military government, the military leadership, are examining their relations and the possibility of an agreement with the International Monetary Fund, which we think would be very important for them to conclude.
Now, the military did initially turn down that IMF loan, but now because, I gather, it's running out of reserves, it's looking again in that direction.
That's exactly right. They turned it down last June. They have reexamined their position, and they are now in serious discussions with the IMF, and I'm optimistic that they will conclude an agreement with the IMF within the next several weeks.
And finally, Mr. Ambassador, if the military does not cede power in the summer, what happens then?
I think the people of Egypt have expressed themselves very well, that they expect, indeed I believe will demand, that the military cede power. That having been said, the military has told everyone who will listen, I've heard them say it, others have heard them say it as well, the Egyptian people have heard them say it, they intend to turn over power to the civilian government by next July, when a new president will have been elected under a new constitution.
And you are optimistic?
I am. I believe them when they say they do not like governing. They are not eager to cling to power. They see that managing an economy is hard work and difficult, and there's a lot of pressures on them on all sides. They, I think, are sincere when they say they would like to turn this back over to a civilian government. They have reasons that they want to maintain influence, and I imagine they are working now to work with the new parliament to try to do that. But I also believe that they will turn over power when a president is elected.
Ambassador William Taylor, he's special coordinator for Middle East transitions at the U.S. Department of State. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Diane.
And turning to you now, Samir Shahata, are you as optimistic as Ambassador Taylor that the military is going to turn over power?
No, I'm not. I mean, the military has lost tremendous credibility among the Egyptian people and I think the international community from February 11th, the day that Mubarak was removed from office, until the present. We have seen incredible violence against civilian protesters on multiple occasions, whether it was the killing of mostly Coptic Christian protesters in front of the radio and television building on October 9th, or the weeks of violence that began after a major demonstration on November the 19th called Mohammed Mahmoud Street, in which over 40 people were killed. Subsequent violence in December as well, in front of the cabinet by peaceful protesters. The international community saw the violence directed particularly against female protesters as well. The military has made comments and done things that really lead many of us to question their desire to midwife a democratic transition, which is what they promised, or their willingness to cede power. They have interests. They have interests that they want to maintain. And I think it's important for us to understand what the military is, and particularly what the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces are. The few, the 24 or 22, none of us know how many generals who are running the country. They were all appointed by Mubarak. Minister Tantawi, the Minister of Defense, has been in his post since 1991. And he hasn't been in his post since 1991 because of performance, but because of his loyalty to Mr. Mubarak, unquestioning loyalty, as also revealed in the WikiLeaks documents. So for them, the revolution was about the elimination of Mr. Mubarak, who had become a liability by February 11th, threatened the entire system and their interests, and also the end of the Gamal Mubarak Inheritance Project. But it was not a revolution for democracy for them or a reform of the way the police does business or anything else. So I'm much more skeptical, unfortunately, than the ambassador about the military's intentions.
And didn't I see something that a leaked U.S. embassy cable said officers called Tantawi Mubarak's poodle? Robin Wright.
Well, we're talking about a broader phenomena here. It's not just what's happened in the past year. This is a country that has effectively been a military state since the Free Officers Movement ousted the monarchy in 1952. All of the presidents since then have been military men. And the stakes here are not just handing over power in July. It's really a broader control, whether it's of legislation, influence on foreign policy. The fact is that the military controls up to 30% of the Egyptian economy in lots of different ways, including vast tracts of land. It has a budget that not even Parliament knew the total for, and it's been secret. And the Egyptian military really wants to sustain the kind of privileges that it had in the past. And power is the way to do that. So there's a widespread belief in Egypt, and I've just returned, that the military will hand over on paper. It will say that constitutionally it is vesting in a new president. But at the end of the day, it wants to protect itself, including liability from the kinds of human rights violations that have taken place on a massive scale across Egypt, not just the number of dead, but the extraordinary number of people who have been injured, who've lost their eyesight and paid a huge price.
Robin Wright, Samer Shahata. We'll take just a short break here. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back. We're talking about Egypt a year after activists launched an uprising in Tahrir Square and 18 days later brought down the presidency of Hosni Mubarak. We've just received an announcement from AP that Egypt's military rulers declared a partial lifting of the nation's hated emergency laws, saying the draconian laws will remain applicable to crimes committed by thugs. And it was Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi who made this announcement, the man we were just talking about. I guess the question is, how do you define thugs, Samer?
Well, you certainly can't define thugs, but in the Egyptian context, of course, thugs, the word is baltageya, have been used consistently by the Mubarak regime as plain clothes, paid thugs, essentially, to put down protesters, to harass opposition figures. We saw this, of course, well before the revolution. This was a regular tactic employed by the regime during elections and also to limit protesters. And the idea was, or one of the benefits of this was, that the regime's fingerprints then were not on the crime of repression, because it was, you know, two groups fighting each other, both non-uniformed. So this is really not enough. Egyptians have been living under emergency law since 1981. It's been a demand for decades, the lifting of the emergency law. And I don't think this is going to meet those demands.
Yeah. Robin, you said earlier that 30% of Egypt's budget is controlled by the military. The question becomes, how much of that are they, if any, going to hand over to the legislature itself?
Well, no one knows exactly what they control. The estimates go as high as 30%. And the secrecy of its assets is one of the big issues. The new parties that have been elected almost uniformly call for greater transparency. They want to know exactly what the military holds. They want to know separately what the budget is, and they don't want this to be a secret. They want the military to be accountable. And this is where we get back to the point that Samer made, that this is above the law, the military. Throughout the history of military rule, and this is reflected. The tensions are reflected in the fact that over 60% of Egypt's population is under the age of 30, and unemployment is estimated at between 25% and 33% among the young. And you see those who are out at Tahrir Square now, many of whom are not the idealized youth of the original uprising, but are those who are marginalized, who feel that they've been lost by Egypt. And they're taking a stand. And those are some of the people that the regime likes to call thugs, because they're not the young, you know, whether they're university students or the liberals or others, that these are...
Oh, dear.
This is, you know, something that's a real challenge to the regime in terms of the economic tensions. And this is one, I think, that's going to play out long after the handover of power. That's, in many ways, what we're seeing today is not just the demand for political rights. Those are being addressed with the election of parliament, expected elected of president by July. But then you have to find the answers to the questions of daily life in this deteriorating economy.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, if you think about what the parliamentarians, those newly elected in Egypt's first elections, have to deal with, it's quite staggering. I mean, they have to deal with a population, as Robin mentioned, which is incredibly young, many of which are unemployed. The poverty rates are astounding. 20% live below poverty. Another 20% live close to poverty. The economy has taken a downturn because of the revolution and so on. And people want results. They have high expectations. They want to see rising incomes and so on. And in this context, it's going to be quite difficult for the parliament, whether they're Islamists or non-Islamists, to actually deliver on those expectations.
You know, it's fascinating to me that during the uprising itself, you seem to have the military and the people become one, and then the military sort of veered off in its direction, beginning to attack the people themselves.
Well, that's what it appeared. But I mean, if we look closely, actually, even during the revolution, even during those 18 days between January the 25th and February 11th, we see that that's not exactly the case. First of all of us remember the Battle of the Camel, the infamous Battle of the Camel, in which camels and horses and chariots were unleashed on the protesters in Tahrir in an attempt to disperse them. The military was there. They did not stop the camels or the chariots from going in. They also, in subsequent days, didn't stop any of the thugs or the violence that was taking place
Are
against the
protesters.
Are you saying
they didn't support the revolution at all?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And in fact, there's even greater evidence of that. We will also remember that during the revolution, Mr. Mubarak met on a number of occasions with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces in a kind of war situation room. And there are photos of him seated next to his then newly appointed Vice President Omar Suleiman, seated next to Mohammed Tantawi, seated next to Sami Anan, also in the Supreme Council, watching monitors and essentially planning a war or a strategy against the protesters. So the basic point is that at some point during the uprising, the military concluded that Mr. Mubarak was a liability, threatening their own interests, threatening the interests that Robin mentioned a moment ago, and they essentially threw him under the bus and also accomplished another thing which they wanted to, getting rid of the Gamal Mubarak Inheritance Project, as well as the civilian, corrupt business types that were parasitic as part of the National Democratic Party, and really potentially eating onto some of their turf. So that's what they wanted with the revolution. They didn't want democracy, accountability, rule of law, citizenship rights, and I think many of the things that the millions of people in Egypt, human dignity, that the millions of people in Egypt protested for.
So, Robin, you've been there for the last 10 days or so. Talk about what you heard from the people.
One of the most interesting things is the whole idea of revolution. We toss this word around, and in many ways what we saw in a year ago was a military coup against Hosni Mubarak, reflecting their desire to get rid and ensure that a general would be his successor. And then you've seen this second phase that played out from October to December, where the military or the security forces were pitted against new rounds of demonstrations. There's talk now that we're beginning the third phase of the rebellion, which may end up being the real revolution, and that is trying to dismantle the military empire in Egypt, that this is where we're really getting down to the basics, that before they got rid of one man, today, they're actually trying to dismantle the system. And that's where you get revolution. We throw these words around as if, you know, accepting the fact this was a revolution. But it wasn't. Not yet. But it could well be.
Now, how was the turnout for the election?
Oh, the turnout was very good. And Jimmy Carter came for the last phase when I was there, and he said this was the freest and fairest election in, you know, the 5,000-year history of Egypt. You can't do better than that. So I think that there was strong support for it. There is something in Egypt today, though, called the couch party. And that consists of the people who like to listen to the talk shows and find out what's going on but don't participate yet. Mm-hmm. And the big concern is how this plays out, if people believe that there's credibility in the presidential election. One of the things that's going to be settled in the next 6 months is what kind of system Egypt has. Is it going to have an executive president, as it's had in the past, a strong man, or does it become one that's based on parliament? Needless to say, the parties that have just won in parliament want to see either a balance of powers or a parliamentary system. And the question is, will the military allow that, because it's much easier to control one man? And there's a lot of speculation now that the military may interject its own candidate for the presidency in the next few weeks in order to maintain control over the political system. And that they could even nominate people who kind of are holdovers from the Mubarak era or sympathetic to Mubarak.
All right. We've got a caller in Jacksonville, Florida, with a question. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Well, my question really has to do with Africa as a whole. It was my understanding that as well as Egypt, but Gaddafi also in Libya was funding, they're about to establish Africa's own monetary fund. This is something that a lot of Africans have been looking for quite a few many years, and all of that money that was about to go to that has now been confiscated, I believe, by perhaps maybe our government. I'm not really sure.
Goodness.
I'm kind of wondering.
Robin, do you know anything about this, Amer?
No, not specifically. I mean, the general point, of course, is that it was uncovered that the Gaddafi regime had over $100 billion dispersed around the world. We know similarly that the Mubarak regime had significant amounts of money personally in funds in Switzerland and in the Bahamas, in the Gulf, and so on. The same thing with Bin Ali in Tunisia. And, of course, the question of recovering the money is an ongoing one. And Egyptians, unfortunately, have very high expectations that many of them that that's going to solve the problem somehow, right? Recovering the $70 billion that Mubarak, some estimate, has stolen. The reality is it's probably the figure is not that high. But even if it's $2 or $3 billion, it's outrageous. But certainly that's not going to solve the problems that the ambassador spoke about economically that Egypt is facing in the current period.
Robin, as you look at this newly formed parliament, as the ambassador said, Islamists are holding about two-thirds of the seats. Who are they, and what do they stand for?
Well, this is one of the most interesting phenomena in the Middle East. After all, Egypt accounts for one out of every four Arabs, and it's always been the intellectual center. So whatever happens in Egypt really influences other parts of the Arab world. There are two different parties. There are actually a few more, but the two major ones are the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis Nur Party. Muslim Brotherhood dates back to 1928. It has long experience. It's gone through many phases where it was initially a social and a religious organization. In the 1950s and 60s, it became involved in some violence. Its ideologue, chief ideologue, was a jihadist and calling for tough action, justifying violence and so forth. In the 1970s, the Muslim Brotherhood renounced violence. And beginning in the late 1980s and throughout the 1990s, it tried to work within the political system. Even though it was legally banned, it tried to work through other parties and running candidates or running them as independents. And in Hosni Mubarak's last parliament, elected in 2005, it had 88 members. So it's not at all a newcomer. It has vast social structures, clinics, schools. I went once to a planetarium that the Muslim Brotherhood ran in Cairo. In contrast to the Salafis, who adopt their ideology from Saudi Arabia, they are very rigid in what they want.
Very
ultra-conservative. They want ultimately to impose the kind of Sharia law that involves cutting off hands and the kind of penal code that is so offensive in Western eyes. But the interesting thing about the two parties is they don't like each other at all. They are rivals. They will not cooperate in the new government in forming a single bloc. The Muslim Brotherhood talks about the Salafis as newcomers, inexperienced, naive. And the Salafis talk about the Muslim Brotherhood as too moderate, you know, sellouts and so forth. So this is not, you know, we in the West kind of look at the numbers and say almost 70% of parliament is going to be controlled by Salafis or by Islamists. And whoops, you know, this is awful. When in fact, it's almost humorous.
Robin Wright, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. As the Muslim Brotherhood moves out of the kind of charitable organizations you were talking about, Robin, and into certainly more assertive political activity, Samer, what is that going to mean for Egypt?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, has been participating in elections in Egypt since 1984 under Mubarak. And now their newly formed party, the Freedom and Justice Party, is the largest single bloc in the parliament. The issues right now that the parliament faces and that Egyptian politics face are, of course, issues of economics and so on, but they're also about how to complete the revolution, this incomplete revolution, how to get the military out of power. And, of course, people are have different views about this. Some are speaking and speculating about a deal being brokered between possibly the Freedom and Justice Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the military that would provide some guarantees for the military office officers, immunity, and so on, control of the military for a number of years in exchange for their leaving the political scene and so on. So these really are the most pressing issues. I mean, the Brotherhood, of course, does have a political program and some economic ideas, maybe not as complete enough, but whether they get a chance to implement them in the coming period is another story.
How worried should the U.S. be about the Muslim Brotherhood, Robin?
Well, I think less worried about the Muslim Brotherhood than the Salafis. But the big issue that they're going to have to face first and foremost is writing a new constitution. And this is where the Iranian Revolution in 1979 was hijacked. It was during the fractious debates over what a new constitution should look like, how far should it go, that there were over 6,400 amendments offered. And that was the moment at which the clerics stepped in because of the infighting that eventually became deadly and said, we need to have the clerics play a role as supervisors. Now, there's a lot of difference between Shiites and Sunnis, between Iran and Egypt, enormous differences. But this period really will define not just what's in the Constitution, but how it's implemented. There's a Article 2 is the key part of the Constitution because under Mubarak, it also said that Sharia law had to be consistent with all new legislation in Egypt. The question is, how do you do that? It's basically been kind of ignored in the past. And one of the questions is, how do the various parties in the Constitution want to make sure that that's applied to new legislation? And this is where you get into these dicey areas of how Islamic is the new order going to be.
Well, that's correct. I mean, you know, Article 2 states that, you know, Egypt is an Islamic country and the principles of the Islamic Sharia are the primary source of legislation. All that means is that principles of social justice and equality and so on are really what's at stake. The Salafis want to change that. They want to make the Sharia, not the principles, the source of legislation.
Samir Shahata, he is assistant professor of Arab politics at Georgetown University Center for Contemporary Arab Studies. Short break and right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Glock, the lightweight, high-capacity magazine Austrian pistol, became the gun of choice for American criminals and law enforcement agents and found its way into crime movies, TV shows, and rap lyrics. We talk with Paul Barrett, author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Join us.
And as we talk about the year following Egypt's revolution, let's go right to the phones to Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Norman. You're on the air.
Good morning. Very interesting topic.
Good.
I'm wondering what this will look like after, you know, when the Islamist parties take hold, what will this do for the religious minorities that are in Egypt, the Coptic Christians, the Jews, and there are still many Jews in Egypt, and what will this do with their relations to Israel?
On the issue of Israel, it's really quite interesting because the Muslim Brotherhood and even to a certain degree the Salafi Party have so far taken a pragmatic attitude toward Camp David. They both have said they will honor Egypt's international treaties, as, of course, the military has also said. The question is, how much do they want to modify it? There's open talk of changes on key issues. For example, how many Egyptian troops are allowed in the Sinai? This has been an area of tension. What about opening the border and what support for the Palestinians in Gaza? And thirdly, and interestingly enough, in many cases, the most important issue to many of them is the gas that Egypt sells to Israel, which is pegged at about $3 a unit, and on the open market, it's closer to $9. And so they're talking about money, but there's also some who take kind of the ideological point of view and say we shouldn't be selling to Israel. It actually goes to Israel and then on to Jordan as well. But there are some changes. But the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't use the language of radical groups talking about the Zionist entity and is quite striking, and the pragmatic attitude. It'll be interesting to see whether they hold to this. But for the time being, because of the economic realities and because of international pressure, they know they're not going to get help, that whether it's tourism and a lot of things will be influenced by what happens on the pivotal issue of Israel.
And following up on that, here's an email from Peter in Tarrytown, New York. Samir, please explain what a moderate Islamist is, how it's different from a radical Islamist. Is it more open to personal freedoms, including women's rights?
Right. Well, you know, this is a contentious even term, the idea of moderate Islamist. But generally, we can put forward a number of criteria. We can look at the willingness to accept democracy and the institutions of democracy, elections, separation of power, and so on. We could look at their positions on violence. Some Islamist groups advocate violence as a legitimate means to attain rights. We could look at questions of women's rights and personal freedoms and minority rights. And I think on all of those different criteria, we can differentiate Islamist groups. So the Brotherhood, for example, fully accepts democracy, elections, separation of power, and so on. That's different than the Salafi groups, quite interestingly. They state that they believe democracy is a good means, but democracy, if it produces laws that contravene the Sharia, is no good. With regard to women's rights, even, we see vast differences between the Brotherhood and the Salafi and Nur parties and so on.
How many women in parliament?
I believe that it's about 1% of the 498 seats. That's, you know, what I've read recently, not an exact figure. So that's a small, unfortunately, small number.
Very small.
It was made mandatory for the party list proportional representation system that parties include one woman on their list of candidates that they are running in each constituency. And even this is interesting because it was always the case that the Salafi, the more conservative groups, always placed the woman on the lowest position on the list, whereas in some cases the Muslim Brotherhood had women running at higher levels in the list and so on. The Salafis also didn't put women's pictures on any of the campaign material, that is the candidates. They would put a flower or the symbol of the party, whereas the Muslim Brotherhood, Muslim Sisters, the Freedom and Justice Party candidates, regularly campaigned. Their pictures were up on posters and campaign materials and so on. So there are significant differences even between these different types of Islamists, as Robin mentioned earlier.
Robin, when you are there in Egypt, how are you as a reporter regarded?
I don't think any different than any time in the past. I've been covering the Middle East for 40 years, and I'm welcomed, I think, in the same way as I always have been when I go to Egypt. I will say on the issue of women, one of the things that's striking is that the largest number of women in Parliament are almost surely from the Muslim Brotherhood, because they won they won 47% of the seats, and therefore just because of the sheer numbers, there are more women. But it was the military that actually abolished the 10% guaranteed number of seats for women in Parliament. So we tend to think
And who had dictated that 10%?
It was the Mubarak regime in 2007, but I think many of us felt that it was simply a cosmetic maneuver.
See.
They put in place a quota where 64 of the seats would be reserved for women, and this, we felt, was an attempt to demonstrate to the West that they were progressive and instituting these pro-women policies, when in fact we know that
but
wasn't the case.
But then the military wiped it out.
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is the irony. Whether they were cosmetic or not, the fact is that 10% of women were brought in, and it was the idea of legitimizing women. But I want to say one thing that Samir pointed out, and I think it's really important. When we talk about these Islamist parties, the thing that's so interesting, the difference between them, the fundamental difference, goes to the issue of which comes first, freedom or religion. And for the Muslim Brotherhood, they're beginning to embrace the idea that you can get into a political system and legitimate rights for Muslims through democracy, whereas the Salafis still believe that you can't get freedom until you live in a really Islamic system. And it's such a fundamental difference, and it has to do with this critical question of moderates versus radicals and the whole issue of when it comes to writing a constitution, when you create a new order in the Middle East, and what it's going to look like. And that's the essence of what's been going on, really, in the region since the 1979 Iranian Revolution.
All right, to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. Love the show. Hey, I had a question for the panel. What can we expect in terms of trade liberalization and also domestic economic liberalization if the Freedom and Justice Party work to hold its, I believe they have a plurality at the moment.
Sure. Well, you know, the Freedom and Justice Party and the Muslim Brothers have always believed in markets and private property. They have never been in favor of state domination of the economy and so on, or communism, you know. However, they also have a conception of compassionate capitalism or social justice or the idea that workers should be compensated and protected. To some extent, it's a naive conception of an ability to reconcile in an Islamic framework the interests of capital and labor and so on. That being said, however, you know, in terms of Matt's question, the revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia and so on were to some extent revolutions against neoliberal economic policies, policies of privatization and trade liberalization, floating foreign currencies and so on. And there's going to be, and there is, a tremendous backlash against those policies. One of the primary slogans during the 18 days in Egypt was bread, freedom, and social justice. And I think that we're not going to see full neoliberal economic policies of the past adopted. And that's one of the reasons why the military authorities rejected the IMF loan earlier, because it symbolized that.
How much power will the Salafis have? Will they be able to form a voting bloc that somehow impedes any kind of true liberalization?
Well, they have about 25% of the seats in Parliament, and that will allow them to be a pressure bloc, particularly when it comes to the Constitution. And that's basically all that the Parliament's going to do for the next 6 months, is write a new Constitution in order to prepare for presidential elections. They'll have to figure out, you know, again, whether it's parliamentary system, executive system, a lot of big issues to be decided. And the social code, this Article 2 that we've talked about, they will be ones that are pressing. But they are also so inexperienced that, as newcomers, their party was formed, you know, last summer. And compared with the Muslim Brotherhood, that goes back to 1928. And when it comes to their economic policies, they're almost wacky. They talk about they want medical tourism, that they want to become a major country for Africans and Arabs to go to for health care. well, as anybody who's been to Egypt knows, you don't go to Egypt for health care. But those are the kinds of...
How bad is it?
Health care?
Yeah.
Well, Summer could probably tell
you
better.
Well, I mean, the public health care institutions, as well as really education and other government, state services have deteriorated significantly. So
they're mediocre at best.
Yeah, you have to pay for decent private health care. And quite unfortunately, even in the supposedly public hospitals, you have to pay for food, medicines, and so on. So there's been a deterioration.
Tell me what's happened to Egypt and especially to Cairo cosmetically. When I was there a few years ago, the city was dirty, and there was trash, there was garbage all over the place. Has the revolution made any difference at all, Robin?
Well, when you go to Tahrir Square, one of the things that's most striking is you see the headquarters of the National Democratic Party, Hosni Mubarak's party, that ruled for so long, and it's a charred shell of a building, that there are little symbols of what's transpired over the past year. There's a street where there are lots of cement blocks and barbed wires to protect government buildings. But by and large, Cairo is the same it's always been. Cairo's always been dusty. It will always be dusty. That kind of thing has not changed. People are really looking for something more tangible. I mean, this is Cairo's a wonderful place, but it's not the physical characteristics that matter to Egyptians right now.
All right, to Mohammed here in Washington. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I live in Washington for the last 30-some years, but I grew up in Jordan. I am from Jordan originally. And I think the West, we always misunderstand the way the women are treated. We look only at Saudi Arabia, and we measure the rest of the Middle East as Saudi Arabia. My mom and my sisters rain their houses, and they still do. Overseas, the income of one person is enough. And family is very important. Raising children is very important. So the mother always chooses to be the one who will take care of the children. Their freedom in the government is there. Since I was a child, which I'm in the 50s now, I've seen women in the military, I've seen women in the police, I've seen women in the government serving equally to the men. As a matter of fact, my niece is she works in a big university, and she has a very high position. So the West really have to understand we don't, it doesn't have to be just like American woman. I mean, other people have different way of living and different expressions, and we have to understand that and respect it.
Yes, sir. And I do agree that there are different ways, and there must be respect. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Robin.
I think he's wrong. I think one of the things that's so striking across the Middle East today in the early 21st century is the fact that women are one of the two agents of change. The other one is the youth demographic. But women have been on the front lines of demonstrations across the region. The tragedy is that what's happened in Egypt, and this happened to a lesser degree, I think, elsewhere, is that women have not been embraced by many of their male counterparts as equal players in this process. When a million women, when women tried to organize a million woman march last spring in Egypt, after the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, the men turned out at Tahrir Square to harass them and try to prevent them. And we had the famous blue bra incident in Cairo. In, I think, late November, early December, when a woman was roughed up at Tahrir Square by security forces to the point that they ripped her clothes off and exposed her blue bra. And the blue bra became kind of the symbol for women. The fact that the military has removed this quota for women removes the guarantee women had to be players, even as a minority. The fact that we're down to just 1% in parliament. The rebellion has not been good in terms of the structural outlets for women. But there is really, far greater interest in political participation, education, being having control over their lives than ever before.
Samir, what kinds of changes do you see the U.S. making towards Egypt during this transition period?
Not too many, in fact. I think that generally America has less influence with regard to Egypt than it did under the Mubarak regime. And Egypt is going to be less likely to accept or follow American foreign policy. I think, of course, there is tremendous interest in Congress about the makeup of the new parliament, particularly issues of Camp David, the peace treaty, relations with Gaza and Hamas, border issues and so on, possible support or perceived support for terrorist organizations. I think that's largely how many American politicians view Egypt. The administration has said on a number of occasions that they are not willing, do not want to use the $1.3 billion of military aid conditionally. That is, they don't want to condition either the transition to democracy or human rights and so on with this, because they see in the SCAF, I think, unfortunately, an institution that they know, that they've done business with, that they can relate to, one of the only remaining institutions in Egypt that they can engage with. So I don't see the relationship, major changes in the short term. In the long term, I think American and Egyptian interests and policies in the region, I think, are going to diverge.
Diverge significantly.
To some extent. I mean, to think about a foreign policy that is in some ways a reflection of the will of the majority of the people. That's going to mean greater support for the Palestinians. It's going to mean not agreeing to support the bombing of Iran, all kinds of issues.
Samir Shahata, Assistant Professor of Arab Politics at Georgetown University. Robin Wright, a joint fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from